The Alex Rupp Fishing Podcast is powered by X2 batteries. If you demand the most out of your battery, whether it's lithium or AGM, whether you're in a kayak or a boat, you need to check out X2 Power Batteries, making the best batteries in the business and keeping up with all the demands that us as anglers have while we're out on the water. Go to x2powerbatteries.com to check out the full battery selection.
Yeah, baby. Wonder if all my bad decisions get accounted in the algorithms. No statistician could dissuade me from my bigger vision. I know my occupation's quite an unlikely place in this world to occupy and talk about upon a daily basis. Our information's predetermined by some biased business. We island sermon to Silicon that push up lovely neighbors. I'm done with paper chasing, think I'm on to bigger banquets. This that full
ladies and gentlemen,
new
here
wave.
We are.
Energy
another live stream, another podcast on the Friday Night Live. I am... I think John's heard me say this a few times. So this is his fifth or sixth time on the podcast. And I always say I am so very excited when I have John on, because John is by far one of my favorite guests, because he's always a wealth of knowledge and a fascinating human being to have a conversation with. And I think tonight's conversation is going to be very interesting, because I am coming solely into this, and I told John this in the green room, that I'm coming into this literally just wanting to learn something, because I am totally in the dark when it comes to trout and how trout and bass interact. But I know that those green fish like to eat those really kind of colorful fish, and I'm just very interested in the interactions. And so I think the best way to learn about something is to learn about it like you know, directly. Like I can go throw trout baits all day long, but why does a trout do what a trout does? Where does a trout live? What does it do? How does it function? I think that makes me a better angler on the back end. But here we are, ladies and gentlemen. Like I said, another podcast, Mr. John Hammonds. John, how are you, sir?
I'm doing good. I'm glad to be here again.
I love it. Dude, for all the people listening on podcast form, John is rocking just a wicked beard. Like it's definitely not as full and mountain man as mine, but it's clean cut, looks good. I love the white in the goatee part. That's just, I mean, dude, it looks good, man. I'm really digging it.
Thank you. The gray is new, and so are the glasses.
Yeah. Oh, the glasses. Yeah. I like the glasses.
They're reading glasses, so I'm 52 now, and I have fought it as long as I can. So now I'm having to, if I'm looking at you on the screen, they got to be on my face.
I love it. Well, you know, hey, it is what it is. My dad did that. He had about 95 pairs of reading glasses, and he had them all over the place. And so, like, every time he got out of my boat, he would leave a pair behind, but then somehow magically have another pair with him. And he would always just, he'd be sitting there trying to tie something. He'd go, "Getting old sucks," and just keep on dying on it. You know what I mean? So yeah, dude, you look good. You look distinguished, man. You look like,
thank you. You
look like, I don't know, maybe you've read like 10 more books since I saw, and you are like smarter than last time I talked to you. I don't know, but maybe not.
That's probably not true.
Hey, there's no telling, but no. So tonight on the podcast, you know, we were talking about this, John. We're going to kind of talk about trout. I've been doing a little bit of trout fishing. I'm fascinated by trout, but the thing that I think fascinates me most about them is their intermingling and interaction with bass. And so we're going to eventually get there, but I kind of want to start with the trout themselves and just learn some stuff about trout that I don't know. Because, you know, I know a bunch of useless facts about bass, and we could probably sit here and have a pretty good high-level conversation about bass. A lot of it I've learned from you, big words that I feel fancy when I say them. But when it comes to a trout, I have zero idea about the fish as a whole. So the first question I have is, like, what is a trout? What is the family, the classification? What makes it different from the sunfish family and bass and those kinds of fish? What makes them so different?
Yeah, so they're very different, even down to their scales. Their scales are round. They're called cycloid scales. They're in the salmonid family, so that includes trout, salmon, and chars. Mm. So a char is like Dolly Varden, bull trout, even our native brook trout are a char. Mm. And those fish spawn in the fall, and then the trout and salmon spawn in the spring. So the only native trout, quote, we have in this part of the world on the eastern slope, anything that drains in the Mississippi River, basically, the only native trout would be, and the Atlantic drainages, the only native trout are the brook trout, and you have the Atlantic salmon as well. But So they're very different. And I think I've said this on here before, but if you look at the pectoral fins on a fish, where they're located along the body, I'm sorry, the pelvic fins, the mm-hmm. further back along the body, the more primitive of a fish they are. Mm-hmm. So if you look at a trout, the pelvic fins are further back along the body. So they're an older kind of fish mm-hmm. and their scales again are the cycloid scales. So that's an older scale as well. Mm-hmm. So the newer fish like sunfish have a different type of scale mm-hmm. and they're called tenoid, starts with a C. So the C is silent, but yeah. Anyway, they're just a completely different animal.
Yeah. That's interesting. And I mean, obviously mm-hmm. you can tell that. I mean, anatomically, you know, it's a very different thing. And even when you grab a hold of it as well, like that's the first thing yeah. I learned about a trout. Yeah. Well, thanks to the internet. Don't grab them unless your hands are wet. I committed the cardinal sin on that one, which I do want to talk about that here in just a minute, because it all kind of plays into something we were talking in the green room about the sensitivity of the fish. But anyway, so like, you know, they're slimy, they're slick, they're just a completely different kind mm-hmm. of creature. What makes mm-hmm. them, so like when you talk about those types of fish, one thing that, you know, is like a, I don't know, a defining marker between two different kinds of kind of freshwater fish biology is you've got like cold water species and warm water species. And in those mm-hmm. trout, char, salmon, they're all cold water species, if I'm not mistaken. Like, what exactly does that mean? And like, what does it do to them, like, physically to make them, like, why does it have to be cold? And what is considered cold water? What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so trout, for the most part here, or anywhere, I guess, but like rainbow trout, brook trout, and brown trout have the highest temperature tolerance, and then followed by rainbow, and then the last will be brook trout, or a lot of people call them speckled trout. Okay. And the physiology side of that, I don't know exactly what makes them not tolerate warm water. They don't. It can become lethal at about 70 degrees. At about 65 degrees, they start shutting down, and anything above 60, they're stressed. So they like 60 and below, and also high levels of oxygen. And those two are typically tied together. The colder the water, the more oxygen it'll hold. I think, you know, you guys probably know that. So, but what makes them just have to have warm water? I really don't know. I'm sure there's a physiological process that you know, that can be explained, but I don't know exactly what that is.
It's really interesting. So like when we think about a trout, like, I guess this is interesting. Like I'm thinking through this right now. Like, you know, when it comes to like a bass, like you'll see bass and bluegill, they'll like sun and want to get warm. Like they want to warm up. Mm-hmm. Now both are cold blooded technically. Mm-hmm. So, yes. Like, you may not know the answer to this, but like, how, like, does a trout want to sun and get warm like a bass does in the kind of same ways that a bass does? Or is it want to actively try to find cold water?
Yeah. So, any fish is going to find its preferred temperature mm-hmm. and live there if at all possible. Mm-hmm. So, a trout's preferred temperature is below 60. Mm-hmm. And I cannot remember, it's somewhere in the mid 50s they prefer. You know, they can survive a lot colder and they can survive a lot warmer, but their best response to eating and that energy taken in, and it produces a calorie, and that calorie gets turned into energy and fat mm-hmm. is somewhere in the mid 50s. Whereas like a smallmouth would be, I think it's somewhere around 68 or 70. Mm-hmm. Large. I should quit saying numbers because I can't remember, but it's a little warmer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's based on preferred temperature mm-hmm. of any fishes that way. That's why, you know, there's certain places where there was warm water effluent in the winter and it attracted like cool water fish, like let's say muskie or striped bass.
Yeah.
And you had that, they just packed on growth and they grew tremendous sizes. And that happened, you know, around here, mm-hmm. all the steam plants before they were offline.
Yeah. That's interesting. So a muskie is considered a cold water species as well?
It's, so you have cold water, then you have cool water, then you have warm water. Mm. So cold water, you know, obviously trout, grayling, some of the smelt. Mm-hmm. Cool water would be like walleye, muskie, mm-hmm. even smallmouth are considered cool water. Mm-hmm. And then your warm water, most of the other sunfish and largemouth bass.
That's interesting.
And, you know, like stuff like gars and all that, you know, yeah. some of the non-game fish.
So when you talk about the classification of like cold water, is that a type of body of water, or does it solely have to do with the temperature?
Yeah, it's temperature.
Just a temperature.
Temperature related. Gotcha. I mean, now you couldn't expect a large trout, you know, let's say, to live in a tiny stream. Mm-hmm. There's just not enough food to sustain it. But that's why brook trout do well around here, because they can live their life cycle within 5 inches. You know, their maximum growth in some of those streams. They can reproduce at 3 or 4 inches, grow to 5, and in a couple of years they die, and they could just carry that on for generations.
Yeah. Now, I went down the rabbit hole the other day on YouTube and was watching a guy trout fishing in the park with, you know, fly rod, and catching brook trout that were not even as big as my hand. And like, it was just, it was such a fascinating thing to see, because he was getting jacked up about him. And I'm like, that's a really small fish, my dude. But like, he's catching them like out of these tiny little holes. And I'm just like, I can't even believe that thing is sitting there and living, you know, which is just, it's so cool. They are really cool fish. Yeah. I mean, so now, kind of tell me, here's something I definitely don't understand. Like, you've got stocked fish and you've got native fish. Obviously, there's like the big duh things about that. Like, a native fish means that it's here, it's always been here, they're actively spawning and they reproduce. The stock fish are put there by humans. But anatomically, I feel like they look different. Is what makes like what? So like, you know, when you think about a largemouth bass, spotted bass, smallmouth bass, for the most part, anatomically, they all kind of look the same across the board. You know, you'll get the shorter, fatter ones up north, the longer, skinny ones down south. But for the most part, they all look the same. But for me, like, I was catching trout and they all look different. Like, you would catch really bright ones that were, you know, like, vibrant, and then you would catch these like pale ones, and then you would catch a big fat one that it's like whole head structure was different than the smaller one's head structure. Like, what is the deal with that? Is that just the species? Like, what, explain that to me a little bit.
Yeah, so to step back to the native versus stock, so people like me, we refer to those fish as wild fish. Gotcha. Of course, native is a different meaning when you're talking fish nerds or, you know, science nerds, whatever.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, you're correct. It's a fish that's been able to reproduce naturally, raise a clutch, and carry that a couple generations. Mm-hmm. And so nature just selects for those traits that benefit that individual fish, and that's what's going to be passed on. Now, at a hatchery, the traits are selected for what can live with 1,000 other ones within, you know, a square foot of water. Yeah. I mean, maybe not that many, but, you know, like, so there's different strains that that hatcheries prefer, and different hatcheries do better with different strains. So you get a more, you know, that fish is going to look a little different. And then also just the environmental factors and stressors on that fish and what it eats can really influence the color. The copepods and things like that. The scuds, the name, you know, the little roly-poly kind of looking aquatic insects, people call them scuds, but they're like kind of like a crustacean. And when trout eat those, their flesh gets really pink, and it can also come out in their colors. So those big, nice rainbow stripes, you know, you'll see that more prominent.
Yeah.
So color in fish is really not it's more of an environmental, like things in the environment, what they eat, cause the color variation a lot more than just the individual fish. That's why it's really rare that you identify a fish by any kind of color.
Yeah.
It's always something else.
Huh. That's really interesting. Really interesting. So speaking of things that trout eat, this is something, it's kind of, we're going to probably go down a little bit of a rabbit hole here, but like the first thing that I noticed about trout and catching trout is they like very, very bright colored things. What is that? Because, you know, when you think about a bass and even some other game species, you know, a muskie, they like bright color things. But for the most part, you know, you want to kind of mimic forage, you know, more natural colors. But I feel like with a trout, even in gin clear water, it's like if it's bright pink and flashes, it's like I want to try to eat that. Like what is that kind of – what is that predatory response and why do they have it?
Yeah, it would be the same thing as like, you know, reeling a crankbait by a bass and just kind of an instinctive strike. So their method of feeding is they especially rainbow trout, compared to like brown trout, they lay in those feeding lanes, and the most aggressive, you know, dominant fish occupy the best feeding lanes. And so they're testing things as they come through. And, you know, there's little eddies in their bodies. And, you know, you mentioned the slime on them, they're very you know, the shape, they're very streamlined. And yes. So it takes very little energy to stay in water, and they can find those little swirls in that stream. You know, a stream that flow is not just the same top to bottom, mm-hmm, especially yeah. with rocks and things. Those little round rocks cause that. So they can find a spot where they're not expending very much energy, and it looks like they're in, you know, water you can't even stand up in. So, yeah. So there's that. And that food particle is coming by really fast. Mm-hmm. So in order for them to take that food particle, they got to be quick and do it. And then they can just spit it out if they don't like it. Mm. So they learn over time what's best. And then the further down that line you go, you know, the food gets picked over. Mm. So at the biggest fish, the most aggressive, the best suited for whatever, you know, all those little factors are going to be up front. And on down the line, the smaller ones and the less aggressive and the less fit. So they've got to maybe hit the little shiny pieces, a lot of them, to get one piece of food, whereas the ones up front can just be more picky.
Yeah.
So you're going to have a lot of trial and error in those fish in the tail end of that.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very interesting to watch. I literally stood the other day while I was trout fishing for 10 minutes and just watched the trout swim around. And it was fascinating to see them, like you said, trying things. Like, I've never seen a bass do that, but I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that you don't get to really see bass like you do those trout, just because the water's not as clear. That's why I say I love fishing up north, like during the spawn and being able, because you get to see bass do things you don't normally get to see them do. But those trout were fascinating in the fact, like, you were like, one would come up and like eat something off the top and then immediately not like it and just spit it right back out. And then he would go down and you'd see something else float by him. He'd kind of swim over to it and like, he'd follow it. Nah, I don't really want that. And like you said, like zero effort. Like it was just, you know, this water's flowing literally so hard, I probably couldn't stand in it. Like it would exhaust me to stand in it for 5 minutes. And I mean, these boys were just kind of just sitting there doing their thing. But when I started fishing for them, it was very fascinating to see how it was very, like, I had to hit a specific position and that bait had to, you know, kind of flow down in there and follow that current just the right way. And if it didn't, it was literally the difference between a bite and hooking it, a bite and not hooking it, or them just not even giving a crap. Like, tap them literally in the nose with it, and they're just like, man, I don't care. But if you slung it out in front of them just right, like, you know, 5 inches, here they came, and they wanted to eat it. And I love that, because it was like, I'm sitting there working this puzzle, like working a puzzle with a singular fish for 5 minutes, and then it eats, and you're like, oh, that was cool. Like, I figured that little puzzle out of that individual fish, and then you go on to the next one, which is, it's quite fascinating. But so when you, continuing down the food thing, one thing that I see a lot around here, the more I'm, you know, kind of researching some trout fishing, obviously want to stay within, and I will say this, folks, if you're planning on doing some trout fishing, there's a lot more regulations around trout fishing than there is bass fishing. So make sure you got your trout stamp if you're in Tennessee or whatever you need in whatever state you're in, and just read the rules, because that's one thing I definitely sat down and read the rules before I went and did this, because I knew it was a little bit different. But a lot of the streams and creeks around here, no scents, no, you know, putties, no power bait, that kind of stuff. And they're very strict on that. Like, what is that and why is that? And then I kind of want to dive into, like, their sense of smell, because obviously power bait, it stinks. That's kind of the science behind it. But first of all, like, why are we so against, you know, the power bait and all that stuff in some of these streams?
Yeah. So the national park is one of the places that is very restricted on, you know, lure type and all that. It has to be artificial, even no scent. Mm-hmm. And that's to keep, you know, the setting up there as unaffected by settlement as mm-hmm. possible, and keep the things as you would imagine them to be 400 or 500 years ago. Mm-hmm. So anything you bring in that's unnatural, they're, you know, kind of don't want. And I know at one time fish managers used to, you know, trout are really easy to catch for the most part. They're unique because they typically bite all day long. Mm. Bright sunlight, you know, any condition. The water's, you know, usually cool where they're at. They're happy. You know, when it gets hot in a reservoir or a lake, fish slow way down. Well, trout, you know, their water's pretty cool, or they wouldn't be there. So. Yeah. They're typically pretty happy, so they're feeding a lot. And also, you know, there's also that aspect. Oh, okay, so the baits and the scents and whatnot would make those fish swallow the hook more, or the bait. Mm-hmm. And there was a real high mortality associated with trout swallowing hooks. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, kind of stems from that. And then also it's kind of like archery hunting versus rifle hunting. Mm. There's places set aside for the, you know, the kind of purists, a lot of the fly anglers, mm-hmm. you know, like that. And they don't want to wade up the stream and, you know, with their fly gear and, you know, and that kind of, experience and then have somebody over there, you know, throwing corn.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess it's just kind of that's this kind of maybe ruins that experience. So yeah. That we try to set aside as fisheries managers, those places that people have a unique experience. And it's no different with stocking. You know, yeah. We stock certain species in certain places instead of just everywhere. So that's part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I get that. Yeah. I mean, there is something different about thwacking one with a bow than there is shooting one with a rifle. And I mean, I've not got a fly rod yet. Yet. It's coming probably. But that's one thing that a lot of people that I talk about fly fishing with and who are enthusiasts of it tell me. They're like, man, it's never going to replace, you know, conventional tackle for you just because they know how I like to fish. But they're like, but it's a completely different experience. They're like, it's the difference between driving a Dodge truck and a Lamborghini. Like, it's just they're both will get you point A to point B, but it's a completely different experience to do that, you know, which is very interesting. Now, talking on the scent side of things, one thing that I, you know, when you talk about, like, they're called salmonoids, right? That's
Salmonidae is the family.
Salmonidae. There you go. That's a new word. I'm going to use that one. I'm going to slip that one into conversation somewhere with somebody. So when you talk about that kind of family of fish, one thing that you see are things like trout and salmon that will swim hundreds, if not thousands, if not mm-hmm. tens of thousands of miles. We don't really know how they do it, you know, moon phase. But, you know, one thing that they are starting to determine is scent plays a lot into that. So when it comes to trout, are they really kind of driven by scent as a predatory instinct? Like, is that why things like power bait are so effective against them? Like, what, and like corn, like, why is corn effective? Like, is it a scent thing? Mm-hmm. Is it a sight thing? Like, what is it that makes those fish have that predatory instinct?
It probably is the scent. I used to know the answer to that, and I cannot remember. There's something about corn that, oh man, that's 20-year-old stuff. I can't remember, but I mean, sin is definitely a factor. And you know, I think it's one of those things that we don't fully understand.
Yeah.
And is it important to manage a population? Probably not. Mm. But is it important to sell lures? Probably.
Yeah.
So you know, there's folks that look at that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But from my job standpoint and what I do, it's not really a big factor to understand all that, mm-hmm. You know, because we typically try to manage with regulation with size and krill limits and then have those, you know, areas, like I mentioned, to kind of protect those, the style of fishing that people like. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's gotta be, or they wouldn't have it in the bait.
Yeah.
You know, it works.
Yeah. It's just very interesting mm-hmm. to me. Like, I feel like, like you said, like, if it didn't work, why would they put it in there? And I feel like mm-hmm. with, like, regulation, and I get there's a definition of the regulation, like, for the purist and then for, you know, whatever mm-hmm. else. But it's just interesting to see, like, fish interact with different things like that, and, like, to see the trout itself interact with power bait like it does. Like, to have them literally, you know, put a piece of power bait in the water where you can do it at and, like, see them swim mm-hmm. over to it. And mm-hmm. it's like, and I just wondered if you did that in, like, a green pumpkin, you know, or something blended with the bottom, mm-hmm. would you still have that same kind of response? And a lot of that thought process comes from, you know, knowing that there's salmon that swim 10,000 miles mm-hmm. year round, and then they go back to the exact creek on the exact rock mm-hmm. that they respond on, and like, it's like, how did it do that?
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, what can we, you know, Mark Sexton, we were talking about Mark mm-hmm. Sexton before in the green room, mm-hmm. and I was at the science symposium down there, and he was saying that I don't know how they got this data, but he said that they've determined that a bass can smell a million times better than a human can in water, which he, you know, he said water is a very different, you know,
vector.
Yes. He says a very mm-hmm. different vector to live in. He said, but like when it comes to sense, if you were to put it in human standards, that a bass can smell a million times better than we can. Hmm. And like,
that's amazing.
It is. It's amazing. And so it makes you think the same thing with a trout. Well, you know, if a bass can smell a million times better, then what are some of these salmon and trout? Like, are they smelling 10 million times better? You know, to be able to go back mm-hmm. to the locations where they respond mm-hmm. and things like that. It's just, I think those are those fascinating, like, existential questions that we ask as anglers. We may never get the answer to, but they're really fun to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah. We, as humans, we view our world through sight. It's extremely important.
Yeah.
And other animals, not so much. So, yeah. So the scent, you know, it paints a different picture in their brain.
Yeah.
It's just amazing how nature is. It never ceases to amaze me.
Oh, it doesn't me either. And one of my favorite things that Mark said at that science symposium too is he said the first rule that you need to understand is you're not a fish. You don't even understand what they live in. And I'm like, yeah. I like that. Like, it makes you, because we as anglers and we, I mean, you as a biologist, me as just a normal person. I like that you kind of, it's like you're a superhero. But me as a normal non-biologist person. Like, we do tend to, and we've talked about this before, like, I always mess this word, I can't say it, make animals like humans. We want to tend to think animals think like humans, see like humans, interact with their environment like humans. And all we're doing is projecting ourselves onto something that literally lives a completely different existence. I mean, like, in really when you think about it, and this is a little bit of a rabbit hole, but, like, when you really do think about it, it's like, a bass almost lives in a different, or a fish lives in a different dimension than us. Like, it's not, it's like we reach into their dimension and we pull them out of their dimension into ours for a little while. And then we put them back. And it's like, when they go back in that water, the way they perceive sound, scent, you know, noise, you know, lateral line, like they have another sense that we don't have, you know, that's an even crazier thing. And so, I don't know, very interesting. This is very, I love that. Now, when it comes to trout, do trout have lateral lines?
Yes.
So they have the same kind of scent system that a bass does. Mm-hmm. It's down the side of their body, some in their face, same kind of deal. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's interesting. Yep. That's really cool. So now I want to talk about how bass and trout interact, because we as bass anglers, when bass and trout start interacting, normally something crazy happens, and what crazy happens is bass start getting really giant. And like, so there's a lot of guys who are, you know, when we look at lakes like Del Hollow, when you look at lakes like Parksville, when you look at the Ocoee system, the Hiwassee system, you look at Little Pigeon and all that, you know, all those things, you're seeing a area where bass and trout start to interact. So one question I do have about trout is, and I don't know any other way to phrase this, how dumb are they? Like, are they, you know, like bass are very wary creatures. Like, they're very, like, it's kind of like a cat. Like, they're very curious, but they'll also run as soon as anything kind of goes awry. Is what's a trout's temperament? Are they the same? Are they dumber? Like, kind of tell me about them.
Yeah. So that probably comes from the stock trout. So when you grow up, you know, as a fish, even though, just like you said, we're not fish and we can't even imagine.
Yeah.
But they're growing up from the time they're hatched till they're stocked with no stimulus to run from a predator. Mm. Now, they're instinctive. They do. So they've never had that, you know, they've never had to use their flight or fright response to, you know, to a degree that you would think of being in the wild. So when they're stocked, they're relatively easy prey. Mm. Until, you know, a big smallmouth comes ripping through the school and you see scales fly up, and then they're like, oh, okay, it's time to run.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like that. But as far as their general behavior, I mean, wild trout, as soon as you step into that little, you know, if you're looking at from underwater straight up, you see that circle and it's refracted light, which means it comes from an angle. So you can kind of, they can kind of see behind them with their eyes on the side of their head. So especially like in a wild trout stream, And I've got, from working in the Smokies, thousands of miles logged, walking in the stream with a backpack shocker and also looking out in front of me and watching those fish run.
Yeah.
And they're very, very leery. And if you sit there on lunch break and watch them and a bird flies over and they see that shadow, same kind of thing, they zip under those rocks in a hurry. So I think most of that kind of thought would be because the stock fish are dumb. You know, they're just, they've not been exposed to that stimulus to, run away.
Yeah. So kind of going down that thought process, when we talk about, let's just say the state of Tennessee, let's talk about the nation as a whole, but the state of Tennessee, like how Okay, I'm trying to think about how to ask this question. So, like, how much of our trout are stocked? Like, because I know that's something you guys put a lot of effort into. Like, there's a lot of like effort put into, you know, trout stocking in all of these rivers. Like, why is that? And like, how much? Like, when we think about population across the state as a whole, how many of those trout are actually stocked and not native trout?
That's a great question. So it's kind of hard to get at, but just thinking through in Tennessee, so we have categories. We have wild trout streams where we do not stock and they sustain themselves. We have stocked trout streams. And some of those can sustain trout year round. Some of them can't. And then we have tailwaters. So the wild trout streams, obviously 100% are wild, zero stocking. The stocked trout streams, the further elevation, the higher the elevation, the further north you go, the more chances of a lot of those fish not being stocked. So a lot of those streams are stocked in the fall and winter and spring. In the summer, they're not. So there's no way for those trout to live through and reproduce. So that, and so what you'd have to do is you'd have to just come up with some sort of square feet estimate of how much of that water is versus wild trout water versus, and then the third category would be tailwater. Now, some of the tailwaters we have actually do have self-sustaining trout populations, which is very rare. But Tennessee, we have that. And it's pretty neat. And we used to stock a lot of fish in those tailwaters. And over time with TVA, you know, TVA gets a lot of bad rap, but they worked really hard to improve the tailwater habitat in the tailwaters for everything. And the trout responded well. So, like South Holston, Watauga, even the Clinch River there, you know, downstream of Norse Dam, there's a lot of natural reproduction. So much so up in Watauga and South Holston, we no longer stock brown trout. So it's really cool. It's a very good success story, you know, overall. So those are, there's a lot of trout in there that we don't stock. So that ups those numbers, you know, but let's move out across the country and, you know, places like in Arkansas, the White River, I couldn't knowingly tell you that how many of those fish are wild, but I don't think very many. I do know they have incredibly good growth rates and they survive very well, but the chance to reproduce in those larger tailwaters are pretty slim because all the there's not much habitat. You know, they need some reds and some areas to small gravel, you know, those little interstitial spaces for their eggs. So, you know, you're going to go across the country and probably find both, but I would say, and another reason that tailwaters are stocked because it's an artificial environment and TVA, at least in our part of the world, TVA, is mandated to provide an alternate, fish and activity and resource because it, you know, technically messed up the natural stream. So that's part of what, and then the Fish and Wildlife Service get funding through that. So that's why you have Del Hollow National Fish Hatchery that raises, you know, hundreds of thousands of trout a year, and then the Irwin National Fish Hatchery, and they get funded through those licenses, and it's called FERC. And I could, you know, that's a lot of stuff people probably don't want to hear, but that's just the way it's set up. So that scenario is all across the country. So a lot of the tailwaters get stocked, and a lot of the you know, wild streams don't, and then some streams get stocked once in their lifetime and they make it, like those high altitude lakes like in Wyoming and Colorado, those little alpine lakes. We were talking, you know, in the green room about stocking from an airplane, and I know a guy that in back in the 40s and 30s he took his mule team and stocked two or three dozen different little lakes back there in the Teton National Wilderness in Wyoming. He was telling me about it. So those have been stocked once, but they're not. So, you know, there's just all kinds of those scenarios, but as a whole, I don't really know, but there's a lot of both, you know?
Well, now why is that? Was it overfishing at a point in our country's history? Is it climate change? Like what is it that makes those fish just not survive?
It's typically, so like out west, you would put trout in a lake, quote, and if it froze solid, you wouldn't have trout. So it was kind of trial and error. And here it's the complete opposite. If it got too warm, you wouldn't have trout. So you have to sustain their population with stockings, mm-hmm. you know, yearly.
Yeah.
Did that answer your question?
So like, no, what I'm asking is like when we look back at history, like, okay, so we have to put so much effort into stocking trout. Are we stocking them in places that they just weren't and we're putting them there now because we like catching them? Or are we replacing a population that we at one point messed up?
No, we put them because we thought it was a good idea.
Okay.
And we wanted a fish that was could catch. You know, back in the Depression, a lot of that was done just to, I mean, basically keep people alive, you know.
Yeah. Morale and food.
So in the Smokies is a great example, and there's tons of data and history and stories and, you know, just folklore around it. But the logging industry was extremely important in the early 1900s.
Yeah.
So when they logged the streams, and we talked about temperature being a big factor, and brook trout are the ones that are least tolerant or have the lowest preferred temperature. So as they logged all those the mountains and open up the canopy, well, it allowed the water to warm up. Mm. Not only that, but it brought in sediment. Mm. So those brook trout were just, they couldn't make it.
Yeah.
So people brought in rainbow trout. They did better. Mm-hmm. So that's how they got there. So a lot of that was that same kind of thought process.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, again, a tailwater was okay. We know trout can live here. Let's go ahead and put them in here because the stuff that's native or supposed to be here can't live anyway. So we might as well have trout and something to fish for.
That's
and that thought was done all over the U.S. You know, that's why you have rainbow trout that are native to the Pacific drainage streams all the way across the U.S. and the world, for that matter, where they can live.
That's interesting. That is so very – so are trout native outside of brooks? Are rainbows and browns native to Tennessee at all?
Mm-mm.
No.
No, brown trout are not even native to the U.S. They're in the – I guess you'd say eastern, the European Atlantic drainages.
Really? So those were brought here. Mm-hmm. When were they brought here? I mean, estimate.
Early 1900s.
That's so
when a lot of that stuff was going on.
Okay, so here's this is one of those things. Okay, rabbit hole of all rabbit holes. All right, you ready for this one, John? We're about to go off the rails here, buddy. So I was at the Houston Space Center, you know, a couple weeks ago for the science symposium. Okay, well, first things first. If you've never seen a rocket in person, they are phenomenally bigger than you could ever imagine. Second thing is, I don't think we ever went to the moon after seeing all of that stuff built in 1969. And now to back up even more, in the early 1900s, some dude went, you know what? We'd have no way of oxygenating this water. We ain't got no fish preservatives. We ain't got nothing. But we're going to stick this brown trout in a barrel. Put it on a ship, and we're going to ship it across to America. Like, it's like you just wonder, where did the aliens come in, and how were they involved in that? You know, that's just crazy to think that a trout made it across the ocean back then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've never thought about that, but you're 100% right. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm telling
you. They came here from Europe. But, you know, the DNA, kind of how you can trace your ancestors. The brown trout that we have can be traced back to a section in Germany.
That's crazy, man.
Yeah.
That's cool.
It is crazy.
That's cool.
Yeah.
It's crazy, but that's cool. Yeah. Like, I don't know. Yeah, dude. When I, again, a rabbit hole, we were walking around the Houston Space Center and they were like, you know, 1960, whatever. I mean, when it was one of them, it was like early on. And like, we're standing, I'm looking at this rocket and I'm like, there's no way we built this in 69. There's no way we built this in 69. And then you go up to like the Appalachia powerhouse and you're like, there's no way we built this in the 30s. How did we build? Yeah. Why are we not building things like this now? I'm like, where are the aliens at? How are the aliens involved in this? I don't know. It's funny. Rabbit hole again. I love it. We're going to get back to fish here in just a minute. It's you're in for it tonight, John, because I'm telling you, when my brain gets going like this, there's no telling where we're going to go. Okay. Have you ever heard the story of the pyramid that they found before they built Norse Dam? I'm convinced at this point that everything that we know about history is a lie. But I'll tell you what isn't a lie, that X2 power batteries really do work. Listen, 40 hours a week, 50 hours a week, I'm out there using my X2 power batteries. And for 3 years straight, I have yet to be able to do anything to hurt or kill an X2 power battery. I mean, as long as they're plugged in and they're charged, when I leave the house, those batteries are going to work no matter what. And I absolutely love them because of that fact. You know, if it wasn't for the AGM in my truck that starts my truck, the AGM that's in my boat that starts my boat, the lithium that's in my boat that runs my electronics, same in my kayak. If it wasn't for some lithium that I use to run some of my GoPros, the Alex Rudd Fishing Channel would not move forward. I wouldn't be able to make content for you guys. And I know I say this a lot. There's a lot of you guys are saying, okay, Alex, but I only fish like one day a week, maybe 2 days a week if I'm lucky. Do I really need a battery like that? And the thing is one of the greatest things I ever heard said was the best battery that you can have is the one that you forget that you have because it always works. And that's what X2 Power batteries are. Like I said, I've been using them for 3 years and I absolutely love X2 Power batteries because they are the battery that just keeps on kicking no matter what. So if you're looking to repower your boat, to power your kayak, to even get something like a lithium jump starter pack or a lithium air compressor to kind of stick in your wife's car or your car just in case something happens out on the road, check out X2 Power batteries. You can either go to x2power.com, go to the website, check out all the offerings that they have, or you can go in stores to a Batteries Plus near you. And what's really cool is when you walk into Batteries Plus, those people are going to know what you're talking about. And I know this for a fact because I've actually helped to make some video material and training stuff so that when you walk into a Batteries Plus and you go, hey, I've got a 21-foot Skeeter with two 12-inch Hummingbird Helixes on it, they understand, oh, this is a fisherman looking to power his boat, to power some electronics, and they're going to know how to help you to fix that problem. And they are just really, really awesome to deal with. So if you're looking to do that, go to Batteries Plus, a store near you, or go to x2power.com. But if you go to either one of those places and you decide to purchase a battery, don't do it without using the code RUDX2. That's RUDDX, the number two. That's going to get you 10% off your entire purchase. X2 batteries, go check them out. I absolutely love them. Now, let's talk about the pyramid that they found in Tennessee. This really is kind of crazy and fascinating. It's as, almost as crazy and fascinating as this trout talk that we've got going on.
Oh man, that sounds familiar, but no, I can't remember the details, but it does sound familiar.
So I saw this on TikTok. Now, ladies and gentlemen, do not believe everything you see on TikTok. I had to fact check this one myself. But really, before they started the building of Norris Dam, they had a seismologist come in and he was, I guess, setting off TNT in different ridges around, the area in which they were planning on building Norris Dam. Well, he set off one charge that unveiled the corner of a pyramid. And this pyramid was like 150 feet down into the sediment. So like way down there in history. And it was like 200 feet by like 300 foot, and it was the base of a pyramid. I mean, like essentially like a pyramid, and it was very it almost was identical to the footprint of like the Aztec pyramids and like the Mayan pyramids, and just a very interesting and like, but the thing is like there was one news story written about it. There was like one old picture from like the 1920s, early 1930s taken of it. And then they covered it up. I mean, they built Norris Dam and they covered it up. And like nobody kind of knows where it's at. They don't have the exact location of it, but just makes you think. And I love that. And the reason I bring all that up is because when you start talking about like the folklore and like the history and like when I love when you start thinking about like early 1900s into like that 1940 time frame right there. And then like then we get into World War II. But like that whole history right there, it's like I feel like there's so much that happened that just like wasn't documented and wasn't really taken account of because like we were just trying to get through the Depression and a world war. We weren't worried about, the pyramid that we found in Tennessee, but it makes you want to go back now that we're not in that situation and go, how are the aliens involved in that? I mean, it's wild. You know what I mean, man? Oh yeah. So we were talking about trout. I was going to ask you a really good question about a trout, but then we got talking about aliens and pyramids. What was I going to ask? Now I've gone and forgot. We talked about them being like below the dams. So we essentially have stocked all the trout that live in Tennessee. Most of your brown trout came from Eastern Europe. Brook trout are the only natural trout that we have in Tennessee. Correct. So that means like, so from some point in history to now that fish evolved here from something else. Like when we go way back and we think about brook trout and like the history of the brook trout and all of that. So are there brook trout anywhere else in the nation, or are we the only place that has them, or like, I guess the Appalachian mountain range? And, and what was that common, I guess, ancestor, common fish that, that the brook trout came from?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know the answer to that specifically, but the first part of that question, so you know, anything that drains into the Mississippi or the Atlantic, the east of the Mississippi was where you find brook trout. And so I think the Arctic char, the gray, let's see, not grayling, the bull trout, man, there's a couple. I should have looked this up before I got on the thing with you, but those style of fish are very similar. And how the differences in that, you know, one of the main reasons is they spawn in the fall. So do brown trout, but they're related in that kind of behavior too, is, and some other things. But I'm sure all those derived from the common ancestor. But if you dig into brook trout more, there's a lot of genetics that's been done, because we as managers have had to work to reclaim some of their native range. And so, you know, I mentioned logging. Back in the 90s, and even now still, but it was very prevalent in the 90s, all the coal that was burned from producing power across the Ohio Valley, the Tennessee Valley, settled out in the Smokies. And so when I was in college, I actually did a little research paper on this. So you could measure the acid in fog, and it was like two, the pH was two, which is like battery acid. So it would literally like burn. So that was obviously, you know, going in the stream, and there's a lot of things that it causes, and one of it is like it leaches some of the nutrients out of the soil, and some of that's aluminum, and it becomes toxic to fish. There's all sorts of problems. So if you compare like the data that was collected in the Smokies in like the 1930s and how far a brook trout lived in the headwaters of a stream, well, those, when you compared it in the 90s, which was when I worked there in the early 2000s, then there were some pretty drastic changes. And then if you look at the bottom of those ranges, and where the rainbow trout weren't, you know, back in the 30s, then looked at it in the 90s, well, that was a change in the opposite direction. So they were getting pinched, their range. So we worked to restore some of those areas where there was natural barriers. We removed the rainbow trout above it, and then, you know, stock brook trout back. And so we moved those fish around. So when you do that, you got to make sure you're preserving the genetic integrity. And the genetics, I think we've talked about this on this show, of just, I mean, the technology now, because of supercomputers and being able to lay out the entire DNA, billions and billions of proteins in a row, and how they pair up. So they can tell like where these fish originated by stream. So
that's cool.
So having, that's really cool. So having said that, now you have to have good baseline data, and it, I was, you know, fortunate enough to get the, do some of that stuff. So there's some lines you can draw. And so we have what they call the Southern Appalachian brook trout, which is in our streams anywhere in Tennessee for the most part. And then above kind of Virginia, and you get on up in there into Maryland and on up, it's the Northern brook trout. So what happened was, before we knew that, we as managers, well, the Northern strain brook trout, just like I mentioned, some of the strains, hatchery strains for rainbow, they would do better in a hatchery. So we stocked brook trout as well. And so all those fish came from Northern. So you got streams out there that grew brook trout that were 12, 14 inches or maybe 16 inches. And then the other streams, they wouldn't get no bigger than seven. So if you started looking at genetics, it was very clear the ones that grew bigger were Northern. So for the Northern fish had genes that grow bigger than the Southern fish. So we've been trying to keep that more pure, we meaning TWRA, the Forest Service, the Park Service, and using all those genetics to do that. So, so there's distinct clades of brook trout like there is anything, but we know more about them, and cutthroat trout as well. There's so many, and it's the same thing, because they get isolated. If you think about it, even brook trout, like let's say if you look at it, I'm trying to think of two very close waters that are far apart, but imagine, you know, a stream that's on one side of the hill, and you walk a few miles over the ridge to the other. Well, a fish to get across that ridge by water may have to go out into the Mississippi River and Atlantic Ocean to get back over. So they were very much isolated for a long time. So, and cutthroat trout are no different. So you have a lot of these little individual your clades or genetic anomalies of brook trout, but the problem is they don't look enough different to be able to get people to say, hey, this is really different. So, we worked through all that and we're still doing it. And,
that's cool.
But yeah, there's basically on the East Coast, there's a northern strain and the southern strain, and the southern strain are what we call brookies, you know, speckled trout. Yeah. And they just don't grow as big. And again, they can live their life cycle in a tiny little stream and grow no bigger than 5 inches and just continue that, you know, generation after generation.
I have to say a trout is they're appealing to me just because of how cool they are. Like, that's cool. Yeah. Like, that's big. Yeah. Like, that's like, I think, like, to just kind of repeat what you just said is like, you literally can have from stream to stream because of just the geological features that separate stream to stream, that by walking or by air, you're talking a quarter of a mile apart or a mile apart. You have literally two genetically almost completely different fish that are both, they're both, you know, within a species. But I mean, like, a little bit of a rabbit hole, like, as the more as we get into genetics, are we going to see more classifications of subspecies of fish, or do you think just for simplification of being biologists and helping to kind of keep conservation rolling in a direction, are we going to keep it simple, or do you think we'll see more classifications with genetics?
So yeah, that's kind of getting to the good old lumper splitter conversation. Yeah. And the more ubiquitous a species is, let's say largemouth bass, they're everywhere.
Yeah.
Then it's hard to split them out. But let's say you have a Cumberland arrow darter, which only exists in two streams in the world. Mm-hmm. And then you find it, you know, 100 miles north, and we've always called it that. And then suddenly it's like, wait a minute, this fish is way different.
Yeah.
So you kind of want to split that out, but there's consequences of that too, with being, you know, and I say consequences kind of tongue in cheek or loosely, like once you say, hey, this is different, then there's a lot of stuff that comes along with that. Yeah. And which should be, you know, you should also preserve that fish so it becomes endangered and all that. So, and then there's also the thing of it takes a lot of money and work to split that fish to a different species. And we're seeing that work done right now in crayfish. But, you know, if you look at black bass, now we have 14 species. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 15 years ago or 20 years ago, was there seven or eight? So it's being done, but it's those little smaller, it's not like largemouth or smallmouth. It's the fish that live in a small watershed, and they get that isolation like we just talked about. And people used to just group them into one fish, like the Alabama bass is an example we've talked about on here. Same exact thing.
Yeah.
So it just depends on the fish, but that a lot of that work is being done, but it kind of goes back and forth. But, you know, the bowfin, are you familiar with the bowfin?
Yeah.
So
I caught one on a frog, and my buddy said, don't put that in my boat. And so I boat flipped it anyway and slimed his entire boat up. So yeah, I know what a bowfin is. Go ahead. Anyway, okay. I'm sorry.
Good.
Yeah.
A lot of people mistake them for snakeheads. Snakeheads.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
So in the eastern U.S., you have the Continental Divide, and, you know, through North Carolina, all the water goes directly to the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah.
West of that goes through the Mississippi. So any bowfin that water drains into the Mississippi and the Gulf of Mexico is now a separate species than a bowfin where it drains directly into the Atlantic, even though they've always been the same fish. But there's enough differences that folks have noticed. So we're going to be finding stuff like that. Yeah. The more work is done on species just because of that whole phenomenon of that kind of genetic isolation. And it's, you know, all the recognizable or sport fish or popular fish, that work, most of that work has been done, but the non-game fish, like for example, bowfin, you know, that'll still be happening.
Yeah. And that going back to what you were talking about earlier is a truly ancient fish. Like, that's as old gets.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Those are like dinosaurs. Yeah. Like, yeah, that's interesting. That's really fascinating. And I love that. I was telling you about this, and I'm actually going to have a guest on very soon that's doing a lot of work with AI supercomputers to not kind of get into genetics of things, but just more make the movement of fish and the tracking of fish much easier than shocking them and, you know, putting a tag in them. We're going to be able to take pictures of them and use AI to detect them. And this is a conversation I want to have with him, but I think that, you know, as we look into the future here, I think the next 5 years, the growth that we're going to see in the next 5 years is going to be the same amount of growth that we saw in the last 20 years. And then I think after that, it's just, I don't know where it goes, exponential. You know what I mean? And like, you know, like you said, like when you said the supercomputer thing and, you know, the strains of DNA, all I can think of is Jurassic Park when he says, and bingo, dino DNA. Like you know what I mean? With our supercomputers, we're reading millions of strands of DNA. And then, you know, then you see like the people up in Siberia that are trying to clone the mammoths and they say, we're going to have one this year. And I'm just like, we got a movie about that. It didn't work out good. Let's not do that. You know what I mean? But no, that's extremely fast. I mean, that really is, John. I mean, like, that's extremely fascinating to me to just think the genetic differences of these fish that you could have essentially two subspecies a quarter mile apart from each other. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That is just to really think about, I always kind of get this, I know there's a thought that always comes into my mind about like how nature interacts with itself and how nature acts when we're not part of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like Steve Rinella said it once, you know, he said there's places that he goes that it's like it never changes. You know, he looks in an area and there's deer there. And when he goes back 15 years later, you know, there's still deer there. It's a different set of deer, but it's like the same kind of this thing they're doing life, you know, and like, I don't know, when you extrapolate that out to think about these brook trout that have been there for, I mean, to just think about the life and the world that's going on around them and like, they've just been there and they've reproduced and they've lived their life and they did their little 2-year cycle and they made more babies and they just continue to grow and, you know, it didn't matter what happened. You know, we dropped bombs on Japan. We went to war. We, you know, Teslas and everything else and those brook trout. You know, I just love that. I love that kind of thought process. But it's just really, really cool. All right. So let's talk about – well, actually, no, I have one more question. I guess just a clarification. So trout do spawn in the fall. They don't spawn in the spring.
So rainbow trout and then all your salmon spawning, they're spring spawners.
Gotcha.
And then the chars, which are brook trout, and, you know, all the ones I mentioned, like the Dolly Varden bull trout, those are fall spawners.
Yeah.
And the brown trout are fall spawners as well.
Okay. That's interesting. So I'm guessing their eggs are hardy. I mean, they can survive. I mean, how long does it take for the egg to mature, get to a point where then they pop out into little baby trout? Yeah. Like, I'm guessing they're really hardy, like, because you're fall to winter, you're going to have fingerlings that are could be potentially living in freezing water. Like they're super hardy. Yeah.
That's they've developed that strategy, and, I mean, who knows why. It seems to make more sense that it would be in the springtime. But, yeah, they do hatch in the fall, and they survive the winter as tiny little trout. And, you know, if you look at the insect population, and you probably have read some of this, they shed their exoskeleton, and in each stage is called instar.
Yeah.
So in the winter and early spring, the instars are tiny, so it would be more fit. You know, you would think maybe the little tiny trout would eat those tiny insects and have more, you know, be able to grow on them. So that could be part of the thought, but I mean, that's just a theory. But yeah, they do. They spawn in the fall and they hatch their eggs in November, and then they're tiny babies until the spring. And what's funny is in the early spring, when you go out and collect these brook trout and rainbow trout that are living in the same spot, the brook trout are bigger.
Yeah.
And then by July or August, the rainbow trout are bigger. So they somehow have, and that seems to be the case with the Indian invasive or non-native. They just, when you put them where they don't belong, it's like, oh, this is cool. I can do better here. What's wrong with this?
Very strange. That's crazy. It's just crazy to think about. Like, it's like they have their babies in probably like the worst time possible. And it's like the most desperate time possible to be a creature outside. And they're like, we'll have our babies. And their babies are like, we're going to do great. Like, that's so weird to me. That's cool, though. That's cool. So, bass trout interactions. I find it fascinating. Yeah. This is one thing that I think to me is still sort of a mystery of how it all works, why it works the way that it does. But we know that when bass start interacting with trout and they start eating stock trout, because I don't think we're going to see many situations, just kind of talking what we've talked about tonight, where you're going to see bass eating native trout in a lot of scenarios or a lot of wild trout. It's just not going to happen. They're going to probably be eating stalkers because, like you said, a little bit dumber. They don't got the fight or flight until something tries to kill them, and they're going to take the full advantage of eating them. Now, all that being said, like when you think about a smallmouth, a largemouth, a spotted bass, we both know they're very opportunistic predators. But one question I do have, and you may or may not know the answer to this, is when you introduce something new, a new stimulus to a predatory fish, and we'll just use predatory fish as a, you know, general bass. I mean, this obviously will affect bass. That prey, predator-prey kind of interaction and that predator instinct that those fish have, like with a trout, and you throw a bunch of stalker trout in the river. When a bass sees that, is it just see an opportunity to kill something, or do you think that there's any apprehension there? Because, and the reason I ask this is anecdotal. I have seen places that have trout in them, and they've stocked trout into them, but the bass, it's like they don't know how to eat them. But then all of a sudden, they figure out how to eat them. And when they figure out how to eat them is when all hell breaks loose, and when it's like they go from to this, and they're that big around. What is that? Like, what is there any scientific explanation as to what that is, or what is that?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, there may be somebody out there that could figure that out. I mean, just thinking through, you know, like we talked about before, the, you know, the selfish gene and what causes a fish to do its thing. And I mean, it could be just kind of like a response to that. You know, like you say, there's suddenly a new fish and it's like, okay, I got to wait before I make a move because I want to preserve myself or whatever. I don't know, but, or it could just be a group of fish have learned it, you know, and you just like, they learn how to avoid baits after a while. It's uncanny, you know, introduce something new, Alabama rig, for example, and it was catching every fish out there. Now it's just another lure. So it's probably something tied with that kind of behavioral instinct that allows them to do that sort of thing.
Huh. It's very interesting. It's just, it's like Parksville is a good example. Ocoee system is a good example of, I'm telling you, we're going to see the state record broke here before too long because they've started figuring out how to eat trout. They just figured it out. I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
Like they were after the blue backs that had been put in there. They were after the alewives. They were after the bait fish, and they were big, but they weren't like monsters. And it's like, I've seen this transition now where like that big one that I caught, the 6.5 pounder, it spit up a trout. And I didn't know what it was when I first saw it. I was like, what is that? Like, I was like, that's some sort of bait. And it was a little fingerling, like stalker sized trout. And I was like, oh, and it's like, it's just this weird interaction. It's like this weird combination of things that start to happen. And I just wondered if there was like, wow, it just like, it's like they figure it out. It's like they go, oh, we can kill that. And then it's like they all figure it out. Like once one or two of them figure it out, it's like they spread the information somehow and they go, yeah, we can kill those. And like, you'll literally see when the stocking truck pulls up, the bass are like sharks coming to chum, like they're sitting there waiting for them. They start stalking these trout and literally the water starts boiling because the bass and the muskies show up and they're like, it's dinner time, and they just feed, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And so, they do. And I was looking at that too. And before the show, like, okay, how many calories does a shad have and how much protein and all that versus a trout? And it seems like shad are better for fish to eat. But it could be one of those things where one year the shad population was low and so trout was left and they targeted trout and just stayed on that target. You know, who knows? Anything like that could be the case.
Yeah.
But they definitely learn it. I mean, it's not a secret, you know. Yeah. And I don't think it's debatable whether, you know, how many trout are consumed by the predators that are in there versus how many are harvested. I mean, people still catch them, you know, and harvest plenty of them. So it's, they're still there, but there's no doubt that, you know, they're getting eaten by other fish.
Yeah. It's just very interesting to me. And what's funny is I'm going to give a little juice away here, folks. So if you're this far into the live stream, the podcast, you're about to get some juice. I've been reading stocking reports just to see where they're stocking trout at, just to see, because I know there's bass there. And it's like, if what's interesting is me and John and Josh, we went and tested some things last year and looked at some things. And one thing that I was doing is every time we would go somewhere that I knew trout also lived, I would see when were they stocked? When's the last time they were stocked and where did they stock them at? And you would be amazed. And again, anecdotal, it's not like I've electrofished these places, but you would be amazed. The one-to-one correlation of stocking in an area in the size of fish uptick. And then when she got downstream a certain distance, the size of fish then downgraded again. And a lot of it had to do with the separation by physical barriers like shoals. And so like you would have a pool that was closer to the area that was stocked or in the area that was stocked, and you would have a bigger class of fish living in that pool. And then you go the pool down that's down, you know, from that, you know, that physical barrier, like that shoal, and the size class of fish goes down because it's like they're feeding on a different prey item that isn't a trout. And it's just interesting. So you were saying that, like, you were looking like a shad, like, is a shad calorically better for the fish? Like, what is it in a trout that makes fish fat? Like, why do they get so, like, what makes them, why do they, it's like a goby. Like, why do they blow up like that? What is that?
Well, so, you know, they're probably able to eat more of them. I'm going to imagine they're easier to catch than a shad. Mm. So there's that.
Yeah.
And then, and it would be the same with goby. So it may not be that they're just that much more caloric. From the stuff I looked at, they're less caloric than a shad. They got different fat content, different protein content. Matter of fact, a trout was made up of like mostly water.
Yeah.
And I forget, it's like 80 something percent. And the shad was like 60 something percent. So, and you know, shad are definitely oily.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. So there, you know, there's all that to go into it. And if you think about, so with trout, you're adding a prey source that took no nutrients out of the system. So it's like fertilizer. So anywhere you have trout stocked, it's like fertilizing that system.
Yeah.
So you would totally expect the outcome to be larger prey or larger predators.
Yeah.
And there's a guy, actually, I helped him with this research at Tennessee Tech that looked at walleye in Watauga and South Holston, where we stock trout pretty heavily, and tried to determine if that was a measurable thing. And he did some, I think I've used this term before and you liked it, but it was called gastric lavage, where they throw water or force water into the mouth and it comes back out without killing the fish.
Yeah. I got to use that one in conversation too. That's pretty good. Yeah. That's good.
Good. Write that down.
Yeah.
So gastric instead of throwing lavage up, you just get, so, but he looked at like a couple of days post stocking in a week or so. And I think the results were pretty, it wasn't like definite, like good, great correlation, but there was some evidence there that walleye obviously eat trout, and the quicker, the sooner, or the closer to the stocking date, the more trout they're going to have in their stomach, which is, you know, that's just kind of intuitive.
Yeah.
But you know, how much does it affect their growth rates? It's kind of hard to tease out, but if you just think about it like that, like it's adding a nutrient to the, like fertilizer, like you're adding to that system without taking the nutrients that's already there.
Yeah. Well, and it's kind of a means to an end too with a trout, because like if it is in an area where let's say, you know, you're talking about stocking below a dam or stocking some stream with trout that also has bass in it. And we get down into August and the water hits 75 degrees. That bass is fine. It's going to go find other things to eat. The trout are like, I guess what I'm saying here is like, you know, there's only so many pounds of fish we can have per square acre of water. But it's like the trout being a means to an end, they're either going to get caught, eat, or die. And it's so it's like you can put a bunch of them in there, which is just like you said, fertilizer, a supplement on top. I mean, it's like us, it's like a guy eating protein shakes or drinking protein shakes. Like, you know, he's going to eat his normal food every day, and then he's going to drink that protein shake on top, which helps with muscle repair and just makes him have that extra nutrients to get the growth to get, you know, get swole. And I guess a bass could be essentially the same way. Like when you think about a trout or any other supplemental, you know, bait fish food source, maybe like throwing fish food out there to them. I mean, it's like not only do they have shag, crawdads, crappies, all this other stuff, and then I also get a protein shake in a trout that when it's like, and they don't have to put much work into them either. So it's like huge return with not much investment of energy, and you know, simply to sit there with their mouth open and wait for it to swim by, because they're dumb. They don't run. Yeah. They just smoke them and they eat them. It's just like a goby when you really think about it. Because goby can't get away. I mean, they glide. You know, they glide across, and like literally they go, and that's it. It's nothing for a smallmouth bass to go, you're mine. Then you're mine. So that's interesting. Yeah, it's just something. Again, it's something I've been looking into and just kind of seeing that predator-prey interaction. And that really actually gives me a great explanation as to kind of my it kind of puts a little bit of, I wouldn't say a proof, because again, this is all anecdotal, but it is kind of, you know, you've seen it with some of the studies you guys have done. It's just supplemental. Like they literally, yeah. It's like you're supplementing the bass. And mm-hmm. you know, when in any situation where you supplement any sort of creature, animal, even ourselves, you're going to see that extra little something out of them. And mm-hmm. and with a spotted bass or a smallmouth bass or a largemouth bass, I mean, that's when you see them go from 6-7 pound class range to 8-9 pound class range. And all it literally was they were just able to supplement themselves in a way that we didn't know they were supplementing themselves. That's very interesting. I love that. That's cool. That's so cool. That's so cool. Yeah. So I don't know. I think the more that I go into 2024, I'm going to explore trout even more and more, John, because they fascinate me. They're a very cool fish that is, I don't know. I mean, I just don't even know what to think about them. Like, they're just cool. Like, it's just something different. The way that they interact with their environment, being able to see them swim around or lack thereof, because that was actually kind of crazy. I was fishing and there was a fellow angler there, and he goes, "You see him sitting right there?" And I was like, "Nope." And he's like, "Look right there." And I'm like, "I'm sitting, I got the best polarized, I got my Fenors on, best polarized glasses you can buy." And I'm like, "Still don't see him." He's like, "You see that rock?" And I was like, "Yeah." He goes, "You see that little bit of just like a movement right behind that rock?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And I was like, he's like, "That's a trout." And then after that, I was like, "Oh, I know what a trout looks like." And there was literally 15 mm-hmm. trout sitting right in front of me, and I didn't mm-hmm. see a single one of them. You know what I mean? Which yeah. is just fascinating. I love that. Mm-hmm. It's so cool. Now, one question I do want to ask you, kind of getting back to the trout, now that we've kind of explored the bass interaction with the trout, I got a few more questions about that. But one I want to kind of circumvent and go back around to is I did get to see some trout stocked. And fascinating process, I do have to say. Mm-hmm. Old boy filled 3 net fulls up of trout and tossed them literally 25, 30 feet down a sheer just like bluff wall right into the river. And I go, "What's the mortality rate on that?" And he said, "You know, man, like I'll have 2 or 3 die out of 300 pounds of fish." And I'm like, "That's crazy. Why are people so sensitive with trout? Like, why do we wet our hands? Why do we not touch them, but then we also toss them out of a net into a river? Like, what is that? I don't understand."
So it probably comes from, you know, they're very sensitive to oxygen. And you know, like a bass, you can take to a weigh-in and put in a bag. And, you know, it's okay for a while. But a trout, you put him in a bag, and, I mean, it's pretty quick. He's going to be belly up. Yeah. So that could be part of it. It's just related to that oxygen. But as far as the fish being tough, you can ask our hatchery drivers, when they haul a batch of trout, as long as the oxygen is good and the temperature is good, man, those things can't kill them hardly. Huh. But you haul a batch of striped bass, you know, walleye, anything, and if something just gets a little out of whack, it's like the whole tank dies. And their trout are very tough, and that's why they're easy to raise, and you know, they're hundreds of millions of them a year raised across the country for, you know, just a different source of fishing and attract different anglers. So, they're tough, and I think I said it already, but, they stock them out of airplanes, you know, and they're bouncing off the wings and hitting the water and go back and catch them. So, obviously, it works, but, they're tough fish, and, you know, there's videos out there of people stocking them from bridges, and just they're bouncing off the rocks, and, you know, 10 minutes later, they're catching them. It's like they're tough. They're kind of – it's kind of like pin-raised quail, you know, like their whole purpose is to be shot. So trout that are stocked, their whole purpose is to survive stocking and be caught, right? People have figured it out. There's strains that there's a handful of strains that do well in different hatchery settings, and those have just been propagated and just over and over and over until, you know, been selected by people to, you know, kind of like breed purebred dogs. Like, you know, it's like, oh, these are the trout that do very well in this setting. And so, they're tough.
Yeah, that's so – they're just breeding trout to be able to take a right hook from Francis Ngannou. I mean, it's just like it's Mike Tyson fish is all those are. Cause that's dude, it's exactly, I was cracking up let me back up. I don't want to ruin the video, but this isn't going to ruin the video, but like I go to Bass Pro Shop, I buy a trout net. I'm not going to touch the trout. I'm going to be Mr. Sensitive. I've been wetting my hands, you know, doing all this stuff. And I'm standing there with my little trout net, my little medium light, you know, spinning rod. And the old boy just tosses these bad boys straight up in there. And literally, like you said, trout hits the rock, bounces off the rock and hits the water and goes belly up. And I was like,
Yeah.
Well, that one's dead. He goes, nope, yeah. Give it a minute. And I mean, sure enough, here it went. And it was just like, all right, I'm good. And just swam mm-hmm. off. And I was like, that's the damnedest thing I've ever seen. Like, I was like, that is nuts. So now
they do have slime. I want to step back a little bit. They do have that slime coat that's important to them.
Yeah.
And it can affect them. And they can get sensitive to disease or they're sensitive to disease. And if you mess up their slime coat, but as far as being just a tough fish to handle. They're tough.
So like with the slime coat with them is so obviously bass are sensitive too with the slime coat, you know, you can be a little bit rougher on them and not, I guess, tend to affect them as much. Is it because of their scale composition that makes them so much more receptive to like disease on their skin?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say it has something to do with that. And also, if you think about how you handle a trout, you can't lip it like a bass or, you know, kind of squeeze it behind the jaws. They're so tough to handle.
Yeah.
So you have to really kind of grip them or come, get creative to handle them some way. So I think, you know, when you lift them out of the water, they just go berserk. Yeah. So I think that has a lot to do with it, too. They just, it's easier for you to wipe that slime coat away just by taking it off the hook because it's a lot harder than it would be a bass.
Yeah, I mean, and I'll go ahead and tell people straight up, like a lot of people are like, use barbless hooks when you're dealing with trout because it's just easier just to deal with them, period. Like, not like that I'm worried about hurting the fish or whatever because, you know, like you said, a lot of them, they're bred to be caught. Like, and that's the thing about, you know, stalker trout, like, you know, they're bred to die. I mean, it's a weird ethical conundrum, but it is what it is. But like just for the simple fact of dealing with the little mugs, I mean, like, cause they get in a net and it's just like death roll. And then you're trying to get them unhooked and they're hooking themselves back and just dead, you know, and then you touch them and it's just like, it is like grabbing a hold of a snotty banana. And there's just no way you're going to get a hold of a snotty banana that's moving. Like, it's just the way it is.
Yeah.
It's just kind of crazy. Now, I do have a couple more questions. I'm fascinated by the trout. As you've noticed, this was supposed to be a podcast where we talked about bass-trout interaction. I got all I needed to know about bass-trout interaction. They're dumb. They eat them. I'm going to go throw glide baits and things that look like trout. I'm going to go catch bass that eat trout and hopefully catch a state record one day. It'll be great. But now, like, trout... As far as like size, I have seen pictures of rainbow trout that are, I mean, they're freaking 50 inches long. I've seen them 10 inches long. What is the, like, what's the limit? Cause you know, like a largemouth, 15, 16 pounds, you're talking about a true blue once in a lifetime fish. But I feel like with trout, like, it's like, I can't figure out what the big ones are and what, like what's small, what's big. Like what's the deal with that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So if you think about their environment, you know, they can live in a small stream or up to a reservoir if it's cold enough.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like the same thing. I'm thinking about a fish in an aquarium. They just grow to their environment. Mm-hmm. And if they get too big, they'll die in a creek. That's why brook trout can survive those little streams. So you can take a wild trout, let's say that's 2 years old and, you know, in a wild stream and then 2 years, and it's 8 inches, and 3 years later, it's 11 inches. Mm. And then a year later, it's dead. Well, that same fish, if you started it in a lake, like South Holston or Watauga or any, you know, reservoir or lake that has cold water and it had all the shad it wanted. Well, that fish could get 15 pounds or 10 pounds and be 25 inches or 30 inches. So it's with trout, it's extremely based on their environment and the food source. Mm. When we did some research with lake trout and the growth rate, and I think it was rainbow as well, actually. And the growth rate was higher once they were stocked than they were in the hatchery.
Huh.
So yeah, so they're very efficient at capturing prey.
Yeah. That's
and,
weird.
They phenomenal growth rates in reservoirs around here or around, you know, this part of the world.
Yeah.
And so, so it all depends on their environment and what they're eating. Yeah. If they're eating insects, you know, and swimming in a current, like we described and tasting these little bits and pieces, they're using a lot of energy.
Yeah.
Even though they're growing, they're still using more energy than if they were in a reservoir where they could not fight the current and eat shad all day long. And that's the thing, like with trout. Once they switch to piscivorous diet, their growth rates just go through the roof.
Yeah.
Rainbow will do that. Brown trout almost always do that. Once they reach about, I think, 8 or 10 inches, they really prefer other fish. And if they're in a stream with plenty of prey, I mean, you see those giant brown trout, that's why.
Well, that's what
they're eating.
Yeah, the next natural question was like, so primarily when you're talking about, you know, fingerling to 8-10 inches, you're eating bugs. They're eating little crustaceans. Yeah. They're eating, you know, helgramites, those crawdads, those types of things. Mm-hmm. And then once they get a certain size, that's when they switch over to bait fish. And when they switch over to bait fish, it's kind of like a bass. Yeah. It's Katie bar to the door. I mean, it's as much as they can fit in their mouth.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And then they just keep growing. Their growth rate doesn't slow as much as a bass. And that's just the difference between species of fish, you know, like anything. I mean, they don't typically live as long as bass, but their growth rate continues to be pretty good year to year.
So they're kind of more exponential in growth, where bass kind of hit a size and then they'll, I mean, it's got to be some exceptional things happen for a bass to get 15 pounds, where a rainbow trout or a trout in general could go this to this, you know, this to this in 1 year. But then if they hit the right kind of bait, they go to that in another year kind of deal.
Yeah. And the other part of that equation is they can find their preferred temperature in those reservoirs where, you know, even in the wintertime, they're still going to be able to find water that's closer to 60 degrees. You know, I mean, obviously not when it's the coldest, but most of the year they can find that temperature in a reservoir that provides them that maximum growth.
That is fascinating. Yeah, that's actually really, really cool, because I've heard nightmarish stories about I say nightmarish. I mean nightmarish in like a good way, like a boo scare, you know, like a movie of guys going way up in the Hawassi somewhere and catching like 35 to 40 inch brown trout on topwater jointed rat baits. So if anybody knows anything about that, I want to participate. I want to see what that looks like. But yeah, I mean, and that's what's kind of cool is, like, you know, you think about trout fishing, you think about fly fishing, you know, you think about little bitty nymphs and you think about this, but then you got dudes who like go out there with full size 3-hook jerk baits and rats and glides and they're catching brown trout. Like that is, that's a big, mean ass fish. Mm-hmm. I mean, and they got teeth and like, it's crazy how when you think, and I think that's what fascinates is kind of where that question stemmed from is, like, you know, you think about trout and like, you can think about them from this to giant, just monster predatory fish that will eat, literally they'll go after bass and try to kill them and eat them. And I guess it's a species difference, but it's a fascinating thing because like, you just don't see that in bass. You know what I mean? Like to go to that kind of next level of predator, you got to go to a striper. And then the next level of predator is a muskie. And it's like a trout can go from literally level one all the way up to level 200, all in a lifespan. You know what I mean?
It's very cool. More levels. That's a good way to say it. A bass might have 20 levels and the trout has 200 levels. Yeah.
That's so cool. That is so cool. That's awesome. So one more question. I'm going to let you go because I know it's Friday night. I'm tired. I want to go to bed. Let me tell you about my day today. So I'll have to show you this. I'm going to send you this video when we get done. So my mom calls, hey, I want you to help me with a couple projects over at my house. I said, okay, sounds good. You know, wasn't going to plan on going fishing or anything today, Mom. But anyway, I love my mom. I'll go help her anytime she needs my help. But anyway, so go over to Mom's house and open the hot tub cover to clean the hot tub. And I guess where we had been in these sub-zero temperatures that we've had here in beautiful East Tennessee, dude, there was, and I'm not exaggerating, I'll send you the video, there had to have been 500,000 ants under the hot tub cover, chilling under the hot tub cover, because I guess it was warm and it was wet, and it was everything that they needed to not freeze to death. And needless to say, my mom freaked out and screamed like a little girl. And, you know, she's like, they're all over me. I'm like, Mom, there's like 12 on you. She's like, there's 100 on my shirt. I'm like, that's like 12. Like, you'll be all right. But yeah, no, it was crazy. But anyway, so if a person was going to go on to try to catch a trout, because I don't know nothing about it, and you're the biologist, you should know how to catch fish. You know, that's the rule, right? That's definitely the rule. That's a joke, ladies and gentlemen. But if a man wanted to go catch a trout, like, what is something, you know, he wanted to take his kid, wanted to go catch his first trout. Mm-hmm. What does that person need to go do? What do they need to buy? Like, what are they focusing on to try to get that first trout to bite something?
Yeah. And with trout, that experience, like most fish, can be a lot of different things, but just to go catch a trout in general with a kid, We have just started stocking trout in the winter in ponds. Mm.
Like the duck pond in Fountain City.
Yeah. And I would highly recommend going there or Pistol Creek over there in Maryville. And they added a new one up in Mountain City. I think it's called Ralph Stout Pond. Mm. And those would be good areas to try. And they get stocked pretty regularly. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, it's easy bank fishing. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not flowing water to deal with. And you can throw a bobber out there with some sort of bait and hopes to catch a trout.
Yeah.
So that's where I would start. And then the tailwaters would be the next step. But wintertime trout fishing, you know, is pretty tough in those environments.
Yeah.
So, but you know, springtime is always good. Everything comes to life. And then the wild trout streams, you know, try just fishing with, you know, that power bait stuff. From the bottom, you may get hung, but it's typically not too bad. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the drift is, if you're using artificial, it's extremely important. The drift is the most important thing. If it doesn't drift correctly down the stream, you might as well forget about it on a wild fish. Mm-hmm. And if the power bait stuff's not working on these stock trout, they will hit spinners. Spinners.
They do. I like throwing a spinner too.
So anything like a little rooster tail or panther martin, you know, and kids can typically reel those in the current because it's going to act, you know, it's going to do its thing in the current. You don't have to worry about your reel speed and all that stuff. So that'd be my recommendation.
Absolutely. Okay. One more question. I promise. One more question.
You're good.
What's the deal with the eggs? Why do they eat eggs? Like I've never okay, I guess two-part question. What's the obsession with eggs with trout, and do they eat other fish's eggs as well? Like, is that a problem?
It's not a problem with managers as far as anything around here. Now, it could be in other parts of the world. I've never heard of it, though. Mm. So, you know, it could be, the selfish gene. If they're eating an egg, they know it's not theirs. And typically, trout eggs don't drift in the stream, so it's just another source, you know, food source. I don't know, but they definitely will eat eggs and even salmon. You know, when I went to Alaska a few years ago, and that's how we caught some of those coho salmon, was the big ball of eggs.
So, but their eggs aren't drifting, but they'll eat other eggs.
So when a trout lays eggs in a nest, and now I'm getting into a world I don't know a lot about because there's a lot of different trout species and a lot of them may have a different strategy, but typically they lay their eggs in a nest or a red, they call it. Mm-hmm. And those eggs settle to the bottom. Mm-hmm. And they hatch there. Mm-hmm. And it's typically a guarded, you know, very specific habitat, gravel size, all that. So it's not like just willy-nilly laying eggs, it's going to drift. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I'm sure in that process some of them drift, you know, they get in the current and they drift. So they just get taken up by whatever's eating them, and trout are, you know, opportunistic too. And it could be part of that thing where, hey, I know my eggs are in a nest and the ones that's in front of me are definitely not mine. So I'm going to do everything I can to not have competition for my babies.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's super interesting. Are there any other fish that do that?
Oh, there's nest predators. You know, sunfish are notorious for stealing eggs out of bass and any other. Yeah, I mean, there's obviously opportunity for.
Yeah, I mean more. Yeah.
Oh, you mean as a strategy? Yeah,
like as a strategy in as bigger predatory fish. Or is there any other bigger predatory fish that eat other things' eggs just when it's available?
I can't think of anything. You know, trout definitely do, and salmon. So that's a great question. I know like striped bass eggs float. God, I mean, there's a lot of different eggs, but most fish have, you know, some sort of nest, but a lot of fish, their eggs drift. That's part of their life cycle.
I call it spray and pray.
That's why we can't have striped bass here naturally, because there's just not enough naturally flowing stream to hatch their eggs.
That's interesting. Yeah. There was one thing that I noticed, like, watching videos, you know, because you always listen, folks. If you ever need any answers for anything, you always go to YouTube. I was YouTubing trout fishing, and like you said, like Alaska, there was some dudes up in Alaska and kind of northern part of our country. Alaska is our country, but like northern part of the country, and then Alaska being out there by itself. But they were using like those egg bundles, and like there was a dude who was like specifically getting like real eggs. Like he would harvest a trout And then he would take the eggs out of that trout and was trying like bundles and then tossing them out there to catch more trout. And I just found that like fascinating, because that definitely doesn't happen in bass fishing. It doesn't happen in muskie fishing. It doesn't happen in striper fishing. It's just, you would think like, and you know, they're catching these big 30-inch brown trout. And it's like, man, that's a giant predatory fish that wants to eat something that is literally so small that you can barely see it. And the thing is, and then I guess that's another question. I'm sorry. My brain's going now. So, like, how is the visual acuity of a trout better than a bass? But I mean, because it seems that a trout can pick up on a lot more sensitive things. Or is it just have to do with the fact that they're living in clearer water for the most part other than a bass?
Yeah, I would imagine, you know, if you look at where they thrive and whatnot, it's typically clear water. And I would say that's probably an accurate statement. It's probably their eyesight's better, but heck, I don't know.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'll tell you a little tidbit that Mark Sexton did tell us about a bass. He said that, you know, they've got like fisheye vision, right? And so, like, you know, they literally see like a fisheye lens, except for when they start to go down onto something to eat it. And he said, like, that they'll get a certain distance from it and you'll see them back up. And what they're doing is they're getting so close that they can't see it anymore, and then they back up, and that's when their binocular vision can actually hone in on what it is, and then that's when they'll kill it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, really
cool. That's cool. I've seen that behavior but never put that together.
Yep, he said that's what it is.
That's cool.
He said that's why a lot of times, like, if you're bed fishing, you'll have the fish will come, like, in hot on it, and then you'll get that back up, and then they'll eat it, and it's just because that fish eye is able to go binocular for a certain distance away, kind of like you with your readers on. You can see a certain distance away, but you get it too close, you lose it. I'm sorry. I just had to hit you on that one.
That's good, man. I love it.
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating. But listen, John, every time I have you on, buddy, I learn something, and I appreciate you more than I think that you know, because you're the only person I can get to come on a Friday Night Live and just pound you with questions that you probably think, man, this guy needs to read a book. But like I said, with your glasses and your beard, you look like you've read more books than me. So I'm going to let you all your book reading teach me something on a podcast, man. I appreciate you, buddy.
Oh, yeah. No, looks can be deceiving. I was telling somebody the other day, they were asking me questions like, oh, I'm sorry. Like, look, this is why I do what I do for a living. Like, I love it. It's not a problem. I can talk about fish stuff all day and I have a teacher's heart, you know, I love telling things that people are interested to hear it, you know, so I definitely appreciate you allowing me to have that chance to do that. Oh, and, and I say it, you know, I'll say it again, I've said it before, but I don't, everybody that listens to your podcast that buys a license, I really genuinely appreciate that. You know, without you guys, I wouldn't be here. And I don't try not to lose sight of that. Sometimes it becomes a job, but I do appreciate you guys going out there and supporting what we do by buying a license and just liking to go fishing, you know, just having that good time and getting that experience, you know, that means a lot to me. And I appreciate everybody that does that.
Yep. Oh man, listen, we appreciate you being willing to come over here and share the knowledge, man. I think that, I think it's a special relationship that we've built here because, you know, it's one of those things that a lot of people, when they think about state agencies, they think about DNR, you know, it's a bad taste. You know, that's the guy who comes and takes away or, you know, checks my license or whatever. But I think these interactions where we can sit down here with a guy like you who spent a lifetime gathering knowledge about fish and we can have cool conversations to show that, you know, that appreciation right there. You know, you appreciate the fact that we go out buy a license because that is the North American model of conservation. That's the Tennessee model of conservation. Like if we aren't buying license and if we aren't going above and beyond as anglers to take care of things, then we don't have what we have here. And I mentioned that in the videos that I made while I was trout fishing. It has gave me a whole new appreciation for the amount of work that goes into sustaining that resource that is trout fishing. Because like you said, you know, it's not a native species. You know, we brought them here and we put them here because we thought they were cool. But now that they're here, people enjoy them, and it's a lot of work to keep it that way. And it's such a cool resource to be a part of. And I think that there's a level of appreciation that goes both ways here. Is you guys putting in all that work and doing cool stuff, and then, you know, you appreciating us buying licenses and doing everything. You know, I get that plastic card every year. I love that little plastic card. Like, I don't need it because I got it on my phone, you know.
Yeah,
I still got the plastic card because I'm like, what kind of art are they going to have this year? You know what I mean? So I think this year I got the raccoon sleeping in a tree. I was like, I like that little raccoon sleeping in that tree. Yeah. I almost went with turkeys, but I thought, raccoon sleeping in a tree was a little bit better. But yeah, so.
Sure.
Well, John, again, man, I appreciate you very, very much. People want to reach out to you, you can go on the TWA website. You'll find his email. You can send him random questions. I gave everybody permission to go do that. I'm sorry if you get 500 emails.
It's okay. But I'll get to them.
Yeah, you'll get eventually. Maybe just stock all of them up. That'd be actually a good podcast show. Email John all of your questions, and then we'll come back on here and we'll answer them. You just got to be really patient and wait for the answers to get back.
Okay. Yeah, just make sure you let me know you're from the podcast, and I would love to do that.
Yeah, I think that would actually be fun. Just put Rusty Shackelford in the memo line. You know, you don't know who he is, but he knows where you live. All right, ladies and gentlemen. I appreciate you, John. Ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate you guys for listening. And as always, you guys are sweet, and we will see you next week.
Yep.
Bye, guys. Bye.